Good evening. It's good to see all of you out tonight. Certainly, it's been a beautiful day, and we're thankful to be able to come out and worship our God, and I appreciate the priority that you've made to do that. It's certainly an encouragement to me. I'm always a little fearful when you're the one doing the evening sermon, and you get announced that morning, and you're always wondering who's going to show up, so I appreciate you willingly walking into this. Before I actually get into the sermon, I won't give a full-blown report on one of the men that we support, but there is a kind of a pressing issue that's happening with Brother Ambedkar, the one we support in India. He sent me some photos that I did not get into my PowerPoint tonight of some really difficult situations that they're going through. They've had really bad flooding that has wiped out a lot of villages in that area. And it seems like they can't catch a break because they went from going with famines and lots of drought to now they're, you know, just literally being swept away in some cases. A lot of brethren have been affected by it. Many of them rely on agriculture and they've lost their crops for this year because of that. He mentioned in particular one man is one of the preachers, I believe, that that he works with is also a tailor, and his, you know, tailor business got swept away in the storms. And in the pictures, I'm not able to do it justice, but if you could imagine the worst flooding you've seen, it's about that bad. So please keep him and all the brothers and sisters over in India in your prayers, because they need them. They are really going through some difficult times, some rough physical circumstances, and they could use our prayers. In 1884, a gentleman by the name of Edwin A. Abbott wrote a small book called Flatland, a romance of many dimensions. It was a story about a square whose name was Albert, and he lived in a two-dimensional world full of other two-dimensional beings like triangles, hexagons, circles, and things like that. And the first part of this book actually goes into a pretty deep explanation of what it would be like to live as a two-dimensional creature or a two-dimensional being in a two-dimensional universe. And so if you could imagine being a geometric shape for a second, if you could imagine just living on an infinitely large piece of paper, then you'd start to have some idea of Albert's universe. But of course, we're three-dimensional creatures. We have length, and we have width, and we have depth, some of us more than others. And we have three dimensions to us. And so for us to think about removing one of those dimensions from ourselves is a little difficult sometimes. You see, if you were a two-dimensional creature living in a two-dimensional universe, you wouldn't actually see flat shapes like what you're seeing here all around you. You actually would see something more like this. You wouldn't see the flat shape. You would see the edge of that shape, because your world, your universe, is the piece of paper. You live in that universe, and so you're looking in it, not from above it. And for that matter, if there were some three-dimensional creature, say a sphere, who were above the paper looking down at you, you'd never actually know it, because that sphere is above your world, your universe. And because he is above it, he is not interacting with you at all or any part of your world. And it's not like you can look up off the paper, because you have no concept of up. See, as a two-dimensional creature, you only know north, south, and east and west, or some combination thereof. To look up off the paper would be to look in a direction that would literally be out of your world. You would have no concept of up, and if anyone suggested to you, you know, what if I asked you as a three-dimensional creature to look up, you would probably say something like, "You mean this way?" You would probably say north. You would point north, because there is no concept of upness in a two-dimensional world. The only way you could ever see the two-dimensional world the way a three-dimensional creature could see it was if you were actually pulled up off that piece of paper like a sticker, and you were held up in the air and pointed in such a way that you were looking back down on the piece of paper from above it, just as this three-dimensional sphere is. And once you experience that, your world would never be the same. You would have a completely different perspective on life because you would have seen things that no other two-dimensional creature would have ever seen in the same way. And you would probably be so excited and just blown away by it that when you were put back down on that two-dimensional piece of paper, that two-dimensional world, you would probably go and tell all your friends excitedly of what you saw. And they would probably all look at you the exact same way you're looking at me right now, like you've grown a third head, forgetting the fact that you already had two heads, apparently, because it's just so mind-blowing to them that it makes no sense. Well, turns out in the story Flatland, that's exactly what happens to Albert. He is encountered by a three-dimensional sphere who pulls him up off his world and shows him his own world from a different perspective. And a very interesting story ensues from that. I highly recommend the book to you just as a personal aside. And certainly, although Mr. Abbott probably, when he wrote this book, Flatland, didn't intend for this work to be used as a spiritual metaphor, certainly there are parallels to be drawn between his simple story of a square whose life changes when he gains a new perspective on his whole existence, and the story of our lives and how our lives change when we gain a new perspective on our existence. And so I'd like us to think about that and explore some of these parallels, especially looking at some examples and passages in the Bible of how gaining a godly perspective can help us answer some difficult questions, and then even talk about how can we gain this godly perspective. So gaining a godly perspective, and what I mean by that is seeing the world as God sees it. So for the rest of this sermon, when you hear me talk about a godly perspective, that's what I'm talking about. What are the benefits? How can we do it? How does it help us in our own lives? The first thing we need to understand is that God's realm, it does encompass our universe, as you know, our very existence. God's realm encompasses that, but it is so much higher than ours. And I say higher in quotes because it's not as if it's up in the sky, because again, that's a three-dimensional direction, and we are well beyond that when we talk about God's realm. If you look in Isaiah 55, if you could flip over there, or if you don't have a Bible, you can read it on the screen in front of you. Isaiah 55, we've recently come through in our Bible class. And in Isaiah 55, Isaiah prophesies about this. Starting in verse 6, as he tries to bring everyone to their senses and say, look, you're doing something that makes no sense. Why don't you try to serve the Lord? Verse 6, he says, seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord that he may have compassion on him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. And this is what I want you to note. He says, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways, and my thoughts are higher than your thoughts. God's realm does encompass our universe, but he has a perspective well above what we have of our own universe, our own existence. And so we start off with that understanding. But what I really want us to talk about is when we have this same godly perspective of our own, then we gain insight into multiple things, but for the purposes of this sermon, what I want us to look at is the insights that we gain into difficult situations, difficult things that we might encounter in our own lives. And so let's talk about a few of those things. The first thing is when we view the world from God's perspective, we gain insight into how we should view things like stress. If you would, turn over to 2 Kings chapter 6. 2 Kings chapter 6. In 2 Kings chapter 6, there is the account of the Syrian army who is going to war against Israel. And in 2 Kings chapter 6, starting in verse 8, it says, "Once when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servants, saying, 'At such and such a place shall be my camp.' But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, 'Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there.' And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him. Thus he used to warn him, so that he saved himself there more than once or twice. And the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing, and he called his servants and said to them, 'Will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel?' And one of his servants said, 'None, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel. He tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom.' And he said, 'Go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him.' It was told him, 'Behold, he is in Dothan.' So he sent there horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, 'Alas, my master, what shall we do?'" And let's stop right there for a second at verse 15. I want you to think about the stress in your life right now. Think about your medical bills. Think about the other bills that you struggle to pay, perhaps. Think about the difficult situations of just your health, or maybe your family's health, or maybe just other stress in your life. Most of you, the day-to-day stress that you experience in your life has no comparison to waking up one morning, opening your window, and seeing your entire city surrounded by an army of horses and chariots ready to come in and take you by force. I think we can all agree that's a stressful situation. And certainly the servant of Elisha had every right to kind of freak out a little bit and say, what are we going to do? Look in verse 16. Elisha said, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And we pause right there for a second, because there's only two of them, right? I mean, Elisha and the servant. And there's a whole army surrounding them. And so at some point, the servant's got to question Elisha's sanity just a little bit. But look at what happens in verse 17. Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Can you imagine looking out, seeing your entire city surrounded by horses and chariots ready to come in and take you by force? And you're freaking out, and then all of a sudden you gain a new perspective. God, it wasn't that he literally pulled this servant up and showed him his universe in a different from a different perspective per se, but certainly he pulled back the curtain a little bit and allowed this servant to see something he had not seen previously, which was this heavenly host, this heavenly army that was surrounding the army that was surrounding him. And then he realized what Elisha was saying was true, is that those who are for us are more than those who are against us. You see, when he gained that heavenly, that godly perspective, suddenly that army that was surrounding him didn't seem so bad anymore. And with us, the same thing is true. When we have our day-to-day stresses, we have a tendency to get tunnel vision and focus only on the here and now. But when we have a godly perspective, when we see ourselves as God sees us, then suddenly those stresses start to melt away a little bit. I want you to look in John chapter 11 for another example. John chapter 11. As you're turning there, I'll recount the story too that many of you may know. There was a man named Lazarus who was a friend of Jesus. He and his sisters, Mary and Martha, they were all friends with Jesus, but Lazarus had fallen ill. His illness was reported to Jesus, and Jesus, being a few miles away, actually waited a couple of days to go visit Lazarus. In fact, he waited until he found out that he died. He goes to the city of Bethany, where they lived, and he visits with his other Lazarus's sisters, Mary and Martha, and all the other men and women that were there, grieving over the loss of this great man. And if you look toward the middle of chapter 11, we see here, starting in verse 30, let's go to 32. They had sent for Mary to go speak to Jesus. And in John 11, 32, it says, when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. And Jesus wept. So the Jews said, see how he loved him. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying? And as we read on down, we see Jesus being deeply moved again. He came to the tomb and he said, take away the stone. And let's stop right there for a second. Certainly Mary and Martha were stressed. They had lost their beloved brother. They had a lot of emotions running through them. And Jesus, in the midst of all that, says, take away the stone. And you can imagine the thoughts going through their mind of, why would we do that? That doesn't make much sense. He's been dead for 4 days, right? And they actually mentioned that. He's been dead for 4 days. And certainly there would be an odor. But look at verse 40. Jesus said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? And so they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes, he prayed to God, and we see the rest of the story that sure enough, he says, Lazarus, come out, and out comes Lazarus alive. Now, certainly they were stressed, and certainly they were in need of a godly perspective. Now, the godly perspective that Jesus gave them is, I rule over everything, even death. And so when you're stressed about this situation of your beloved brother being dead, and you have forgotten that I am in control of everything, then you need a reminder. And that's exactly what he did. He says, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? All you need to do is believe in me and my power. And he showed them, he gave them that new perspective of, oh, of course, Jesus is the ruler over life and death. And they, having that new perspective, they fell at Jesus' feet and certainly worshiped him all the more. Now, God doesn't work miracles in this way today. Certainly, if God can cause the dead to be raised, then don't you think he can handle the stresses in your life through non-miraculous means, through providence, stepping in and causing things to take place in your life in such a way that things would work out? God will take care of you, right? If you flip over to Matthew chapter 6, we see another example of this, another recounting of this when Jesus is preaching the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 6. Starting in verse 25. In Matthew 6, verse 25, Jesus here is speaking. He says, therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food? Is not the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? And why are you anxious about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin, Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Therefore, do not be anxious, saying, what shall we eat? What shall we drink? Or what shall we wear? For the Gentiles seek after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them all. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. Jesus here saying, you need a godly perspective. And the godly perspective is, God takes care of everything that he has created in some way, shape, form, or fashion. Even the birds of the field, even the grass, all those things are being taken care of. How much more do you think he's going to take care of something that he created in his own image? You need that godly perspective from time to time. And here Jesus is trying to give us that so that we don't have that stress in our lives over things that frankly are somewhat insignificant. You see, with God, all things are possible, Matthew 19, verse 26. Another thing that we need to think about from time to time is our own suffering and death. And what does a godly perspective do for that? We talk about stress. Well, certainly suffering, and I guess by suffering here, I mean suffering for the cause of Christ and being persecuted and things like that. And then also just our own death, our own mortality. That's the ultimate stress for many of us. What does having a godly perspective do for that? How do we gain insight into how we should view our own suffering and our own death? Well, first of all, flip over to James chapter 1. James chapter 1. In James chapter 1, James starts right out of the gate with some difficult things that we are called as Christians to do. And one of the things that James says, that James says in verse 2, he says, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. That's a hard thing to think about. When you're going through the fire, so to speak, when you are being persecuted, reviled, made fun of, picked on, beaten, put in jail. You know, things that we don't even think about in this country, but that are going on in this world right now. When you think about that, going through that at the moment, that's a hard thing to go through. And it's very easy for us to get bogged down and have a pity poor me party about how bad we're suffering. And James says, no. You count it all joy when you meet trials of various kinds. And I may have pointed this out before, but this is not counted all joy after the fact, right? After you've gone through those trials and you have the opportunity to look back on your life and say, oh, yeah, that made me so much stronger. No. This is saying count it all joy when you go through these trials, as they are happening. That's tough. But when you have a godly perspective, it can be done. And you know how I know? Because we see the apostles and the disciples in Acts do that very thing. We won't take time to look over there for sake of time. But you remember in Acts when the disciples are preaching and teaching about Jesus after he's been crucified and resurrected. They are preaching about him even though they're being told not to. And sure enough, they are hauled off to jail. They are beaten. And you remember as they are after they've left that and they're going back to their homes, they were rejoicing, being happy that they were found worthy of suffering for the cause of Christ. It can be done. And James here says, do it. It's not a matter of it can be done. He's saying it should be done. We should look at our own suffering with joy as it's occurring to us. And when we have a godly perspective, We can do that. We won't take time to, or you can take time to flip over there if you want, but it's up here on the screen for you. Matthew chapter 5, back also in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sakes, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you, utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account." He says, "Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Is it really that easy to think about yourself as being blessed when you're being persecuted, when you're being made fun of, and when you're standing up for what's right and you're the only person doing it? Well, when you have a godly perspective, you start to realize that all this little petty stuff that's going on, of people making fun of you, maybe a job that you got passed over for because you weren't willing to work on a Wednesday night or something like that, all those little petty things, they don't mean anything in eternity. And when you have that godly perspective, those decisions become super easy. Super easy. It's not even a thought of, maybe I should back down on this stance for the truth. No, no, no. There's none of that. You don't see any waffling on Paul's part because he had a godly perspective. He understood this is for real. This is not an academic exercise. And so he was fully determined in his own faith to do what was right no matter what. And it was not even an option for him to do otherwise. When we have that godly perspective, we can gain insight into how we should view our own suffering. Even our own death, right? If you look in Philippians chapter 1, Paul here talking about his own death. He says, "For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I'm to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose," he's talking about life or death, "which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I'm hard-pressed between the two, because my desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that's far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account." Paul here says, you know, even if it comes down to my own death, you know, when I look at my own death, I'm not scared. I'm not stressed out about it. I'm ready for it. And when we start viewing death through a godly perspective, we realize that death is not a finality. It's nothing more than a phase change. And so death can all of a sudden become a joyous thing for those who are dying in the Lord. And so when we have that godly perspective, it changes our world completely and how we view it. When we have a godly perspective on things, when we see the world as God sees it, it also gives us some insight into how we should view and how we be able to answer some difficult questions. Questions like, why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? That sound familiar? We're studying that right now in our Bible classes Sunday mornings at Job. You know, why does God allow bad things? How could a loving God let the baddest things happen to his most precious creatures, mankind? How could that possibly be something that God would allow? Questions like, why does God punish the good along with the bad here on earth? I think maybe a question came up this morning of, when God would tell an army to come through and wipe out a nation. You know, certainly there were some good people there. Maybe there were some young children there. You know, why would God allow those good to be punished along with the bad here on earth? That's a tough question. Why didn't God just give us all the answers to his plan for us? Why do we have to go searching the scriptures? Why does it have to be so hard? That's a tough question to answer. Like, why would God make something so complicated that there would be people who wouldn't, and I put all the rest of this in quotes, wouldn't be able to find the answers to them? You know, why, is God trying to trick us all? Is he trying to trip us all up? Why didn't he just give us all the answers? Why does God make us with inherent certain desires and urges within us, but then he requires us to suppress them? You ever think about that? Like, you know, we have natural urges and desires for power, for wealth, for comfort, right? Sexual desires, desires for other things. We have all these natural desires inside us, but many of those desires God has asked and even required us to suppress them to some degree. Why would God do that? He's the one who made us this way. That's a hard question, right? Why did God make our bodies so imperfect? I was reading a study the other day that talked about the human foot and how the human foot was clearly an imperfect design and couldn't have been designed by an all-knowing God, because feet wear out and you can't really walk barefooted for too long before you need shoes. And just the fact that we need shoes shows that there can't be a God, because why would, you know, it's kind of like the old Willy Wonka thing. If God had wanted us to walk, why would he have invented roller skates? Well, that's, you know, it's a ridiculous line of logic. But that's what they go with. You know, why did God make our bodies so imperfect? Why do we wear down over time? Why didn't God just make our bodies to be self-rejuvenating? It's a tough question. I would submit to you that all these questions have answers. And they have legitimate answers. But they have answers that require a higher viewpoint than our current existence affords us. When you live your life and you focus on just the here and now, on just your, you know, 60, 70, 80, 90 years of living, and that's it, when you think about life and existence in those terms, those questions I just flashed up before you, they don't have any good answers. But when you start thinking of life and existence in terms of God's viewpoint, then some of those start to have answers. Why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? Right? We talked about this in class this morning. You know, Job is all about the fact that, you know, he's blaming God for something when he should have been blaming Satan. Because Satan, even from the very beginning, tricking Eve into partaking of that fruit, allowed sin to come into the world. And now that sin is in the world, there is suffering that's going to happen. And every bit of suffering to a good person that's happened since then can be attributed to Satan in some regard. Why does God punish the good along with the bad? That all depends on how you define punish. If you think about children, you know, children who are brutally murdered by an army, a marauding band of an army coming in and destroying a city, and all the kids get killed as a result. Oh, sure, that could be viewed as punishment, but, and you know, the Israelites, that some of those battles that they fought back when they took over the land of Canaan, you know, some of those questions might have been going through their mind too. Why are we killing these kids? They're just kids. The answer is because that wasn't punishment for them to die. That was salvation. Because when children are small, they don't have sin. They are innocent creatures. But children who are innocent children who are raised by wicked parents, you know what happens to those kids? They turn out wicked. And when they turn out wicked, then when they die and go to hell, yes, that is punishment. But while they're still babies, if something is to happen to them and they die and they go to heaven, that's not punishment that they die. That's actually salvation. And so when you stop looking at the world in this small little, you know, three-dimensional, four-dimensional, if you want to think of time as a dimension, package that we are existing in, when you want to think about answers to these questions, you have to get out of that mindset of the here and now. Why doesn't God just give us all the answers to his plans? You know, that's a question that really is similar to the question of why can't I just find a butterfly or a caterpillar in a cocoon and cut it open out of its cocoon and just let it go ahead and fly instead of making it work its way out? The answer is, if you do that to a butterfly when it's trying to work its way out of a cocoon, you just killed it, because it'll never develop and it'll never grow. In the same way, if God just gives us all the answers, one answer to this question is, if God just gives us all the answers to all his plans for us, then we never grow, we never develop a true love for him, And we're never pleasing to him as a result, the way he wants to be pleased here. But we have to get out of the mindset of, you know, it should just be easy. We should just be given everything. Why does God give us inherent desires and urges and then require us to suppress them? You know, again, you could think of that in terms of self-control and growing our character. If God never gave us any urges or desires or anything like that for us to suppress, there would be no growth for us. There would be no reason for us to ever turn away from God. And God wants us to follow him because we want to, not because there's no other choice. There's, you know, there's nothing else out there. Why did God make our bodies so imperfect? Again, the quotes are there for a reason. Our bodies are not imperfect. Our bodies are perfectly made for the uses that God intended for them and for the lifespan for which God intended them. You know, it's funny, when you buy technology, if you buy a new iPhone or something like that, you can bet you'll get about 5 years out of it, assuming you don't drop it. You get about 5 years out of it, max, and then it's time to get a new one. And that's looked at as a stroke of genius on Steve Jobs' part, because it's called planned obsolescence, right? I mean, it's supposed to wear down over time, right? That's how he got to be a billionaire. Why is it genius when a businessman does that, but yet it's a flaw in our Creator when he makes us to be obsolescent or obsolete? He plans for us to be obsolete. We won't take time to look, but you remember back back in the Old Testament in Genesis when God says, my spirit will not strive with man forever, right? But he gives him 120 years. It was planned for us, for our bodies to wear out. Otherwise, how would we ever get to heaven, right? We have to have, we have to shed this old body, as Paul talked about, in order to put on that new imperishable body. So all these questions, and many more questions, right, have answers, but they require us to get out of this mindset of that this world is all there is. This world as we see it is all there is. But I would submit to you, and very important here, there are some questions, right? We should prepare ourselves for the possibility, in fact, the probability that for some of these questions, we're not going to get the answers. At least not while we're here on earth, right? I'm not going to steal any of the Bible class teacher's thunder about Job, right? But spoiler alert, Job never finds out why any of that happened to him, right? And that seems awful. Like, that just seems like God's just toying with him. But it's not. If Job had been given the reason why, he probably wouldn't have understood it, even if it were told to him. You know, it's kind of like with me when I taught high school. You know, I would teach a kid algebra, and the kid would come up and say, you know, why do I need to learn algebra? Well, if I had come to him and said, well, you need to learn algebra because if you know how to do this in algebra, then that'll help you find a derivative in calculus. How's that answer going to go over, right? Some of you high school kids are asking the same question that those high school kids used to ask me, which is, what's a derivative and what's calculus, right? You get answers, but those answers mean nothing to you. And in many ways, right, when we look for answers sometimes, even if we got those answers, we wouldn't understand them. Job probably would not have understood why God did what he did, even if God had told him. Other things like Abraham, when he sacrificed Isaac, right? He was certainly thinking, why am I sacrificing the kid that I waited 25 years for in the first place when I was told that that son was going to be the one through whom all nations would be blessed? Well, if God had told him on the front end, okay, I'm going to ask you to sacrifice your son, but here's why I'm really doing it. I'm really testing you to see just how much faith you have in me. Do you understand that the whole test has been blown right then? God can't give answers to Abraham at that point, because to give the answer is to completely ruin the purpose of the test or the trial in the first place. And we need to remember things like that ourselves. There are times when we're going to go through things and we ask, why? Why is that happening? We're going to see things on the news and we're asked, why? Why is that happening? And we're not going to get an answer. And sometimes we have to understand that we're not going to get an answer because we wouldn't understand it even if we got it. And if we got the answer, sometimes that would ruin the whole point of whatever experience was taking place in the first place. So, very quickly, how can we ever expect to gain this perspective similar to God's perspective, right? We talked about with the square, there was no way for him to ever know there was anything else unless the sphere pulled him off and showed him that. God's not going to do that for us. He's not going to pull us up out of this existence and turn us and point us and show us this is what's going on in your world right now and here's why, right? That's not going to happen while we're still alive. So how can we ever expect to gain this perspective? Well, I got a few suggestions, and we'll run through them quickly. I apologize for the time, but certainly these are things that we need to know. Like, how do we gain this perspective so that we can answer some of these difficult questions, so that we can make it through some of these difficult situations? The first thing I would point out to you is we need to read, and we need to study, and we need to meditate on God's Word, because that's how God's communicating His perspective to us. He's not going to pull us up and show us firsthand, but at the very least, He can explain to us what He sees. And that's exactly what He's doing in God's Word. Another thing is for us to pray to God to receive that perspective and that insight. Not only is God communicating with us, but we can also communicate with Him and say, God, I need some, some sort of explanation of what's going on. James 1, verse 5, if you're there in James, you can look there. In verse 5, he says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to him. We need to be able to pray to God and ask God, God, what is happening? Why is this happening? And God will give us wisdom to either understand why something is happening the way it is, or He will give us the wisdom to not ask the question anymore because that answer would not be forthcoming and we wouldn't understand it anyway. Another thing, come worship with us. You know, we build each other up here. We talk about that often. We build each other up as brothers and sisters in Christ. But we don't just mean, you're a great guy and, you look pretty today and all that. That's not building each other up. The way we build each other up in a spiritual sense is we build each other up through lifting our burdens off each other. But we also build each other up through spiritual conversations. Larry has insight that I don't have sometimes. That when he explains that in a comment in class, I think, that is genius. Like, I never would have come up with that on my own, right? And many of you have, throughout the years, have come up with comments or said something to me that has just completely opened my eyes to something in a spiritual way that I had not seen before. And so that would not have happened had you or I not come to worship that day. Come worship with us. That's how you can gain a godly perspective, right? Psalm 73, we won't take time to look over there, but the writer there is talking about he's very confused about the world and doesn't understand why bad things or good things are happening to bad people. But he says, but when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God, and then I discerned their end. And he goes on through the rest of that chapter, understanding that that's a temporal thing, and they will meet their ultimate fate at the end of time. Lastly, train yourself to view situations as God would see them, right? Paul here in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, he says, for this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. Paul had trained his mind, right? He noticed, he says, a light momentary affliction. His life was anything but light in terms of persecution by most men's standards. But that's how he viewed it, because he had trained himself to view things that were unseen. How do you gain a godly perspective? You read, you study, you meditate, you pray. You come worship with fellow brothers and sisters of like mind. And you train your mind. Put yourself in situations and ask yourself, how does God view this? Again, I thank you for your attention and your time. Perhaps there's someone here this evening who's been just feeling oppressed or beat down by life. Maybe at some point you obeyed the gospel, but life just kind of has brought you down and you start finding yourself asking why is this happening? Maybe you're confused by the state of the world and you're just very confused by it all, and you're starting to question your faith and whether God even exists. Hopefully this lesson has helped you out in that regard, or at least maybe put you on the right path. And hopefully you understand that all the answers that you're going to get, they're going to come from God. Ultimately, one day they will come from God. And so there is no choice, really, no good choice, except to follow after the Lord. And so if you've made that decision in the past, but you've fallen away, as it were, maybe now is the time for you to pick yourself back up and say, I'm going to come at this with a new perspective, a godly perspective. Maybe you've never put on the Lord in baptism. Maybe you've never made that decision to walk with Christ. Now is that perfect time. You can take your life and change it for the better by viewing it through a godly lens. And certainly we can all meet each other in heaven and be saved. And it will all be worth it. If there's any way we can serve you this evening, please come as we stand and sing.